Session number 27807, Reel 10.
We're talking of a typical daytime raid over Germany in March 1945, including the odd reference to night raids as
right.
well, but I mean as appropriate. Now you've taxied with some difficulty sometimes to the takeoff point. What's the takeoff procedure?
Well, of course,
I
should add that in daylight, taxiing the aircraft was a lot more simple than at night, to which I've alluded. The takeoff point were where the aircraft assembled on the runway in use, and in their turn they would receive a green light from the runway controller. On receiving the green light, the aircraft, it would be pointed at your aircraft. You would turn onto the runway, line the aircraft up, put the brakes on, and hold. Once you were sure that the tail wheel was in line with the direction of takeoff, you'd advance the power on the engines. I used to do this myself. Sometimes other pilots let the engineers, but I would advance the four throttles as we began to take off. There was a tendency for the Lank to swing to port.
Why?
Well, because of the torque of the propellers. They're all rotating, and they would turn to tend on the Merlin engine Lank. They would tend to the aircraft to swing to port. So in advancing the throttles, what one did was you led with the port engine in advance of the others to counteract the swing. In the early part of the roll, with the tail was still on the ground, you could, if a swing developed, you could apply a little touch of brake in the appropriate direction. But it was unwise to do it once you got any speed on, of course. You needed every ounce of lift and every mile per hour to get the aircraft at the end of the runway. Once full power had been achieved, the engineer would tighten a screw system so that the throttles were locked up and couldn't slide back. And we would take off roughly at about 110, 115 miles per hour. You could feel the aircraft beginning to want to fly. You pulled back the stick and off you went and climbed straight ahead. As you left or were leaving the runway, the next aircraft would be signaled to go on. And so on. So you could take off about every 15 to 20 seconds quite easily in daylight and even at night.
Now, once you're off...
Well, once we were airborne, we would start climbing to the sort of location where we would assemble. And as soon as possible, we would form up in our VIC, a three aircraft. And the three aircraft would then... This might be... 4,000 or 5,000 feet, would then start flying on a course which all the other aircraft would adopt, so that one would gradually drift into that course, and the VIC leader would position himself so that he was in the right position, and then the whole squadron would climb en route, climbing up to probably the height that had been ordained for the first leg or so. It might not be full height.
This is very different from a night raid with a bomber stream where each aircraft flies as an individual aircraft.
Absolutely.
This is in a formation of
yes,
a VIC
yes.
within a bigger formation.
Yes. Bearing in mind that three group, in which 115 was part of, they were doing predominantly daylight raids, and so they adopted this loose formation system. The rest of the RAF, or Bomber Command, if they were flying in daylight, they flew more or less as if they were flying at night. They didn't practice a particular...
So this was unique to three group?
Basically, yes.
Now, so you're off. Take me through... I mean, this is difficult, and in a way it's silly without having being sat in the cockpit of a Lancaster. But what... Can you take me through the flying controls you had on a Lancaster, if you can, or as much as you remember?
Well, the flying controls on the Lancaster are exactly the same as the flying controls on any other aircraft. There would be a control column, and at the top of the column there would be a half wheel or a wheel, depending on the aircraft. on that column, we would have a button for the RT, and we would have a lever for the brakes. When one pulled the lever for the brakes, air would enter the system. If the rudder pedals were crosswise, or in fact steering straight ahead, each wheel were braked at the same amount, by the same amount. If the rudder pedals were either to port or starboard, then the port wheel would brake only if it was the rudder was to port, and if the rudder was to starboard, you want to turn starboard as if you were driving a pedal car, then it would brake the right-hand wheel. This was the system on the ground. In the air, we had the wheel, which manipulated the ailerons on the wings. This lifted or lowered either wing as required. Forward and aft movement on the control column itself activated the elevators, which made it the aircraft either dive or climb. This is a basic procedure. This is a simple rule of flight.
Now, what instruments did you have to assist you in knowing?
Well, flight instruments consisted of an artificial horizon. This was a gyro-controlled horizon in a small sphere, mount with an aircraft, a small dummy aircraft, miniature of about an inch wingspan, mounted in the center. And what one saw was your aircraft's position relative to the artificial horizon, which in effect was perhaps the normal horizon. So if you climbed the aircraft, the horizon would be below the aircraft, and if you dive the aircraft, the horizon would be above the nose of the aircraft. If you were banking left or right, you would see a wing dip below the center section. That was a key instrument. Above it, we'd have a direction indicator. This was a 0 to 360 degree circular instrument, which again ran on a gyro. And this on take or before takeoff was preset to the heading of the aircraft. If we were taking off on runway 320, we would probably set that indicated to 320 degrees, and we would also set the normal compass, that is the magnetic compass, to the first course to fly, so that when one settled down, one could line up that compass and make sure that you're heading in the on the correct course. In daylight, there were clouds. There were occasionally a horizon, but one used the instruments as much as possible because they were a better indication than feel. In an aircraft, when you were flying, you could feel that you were diving and you could react, and what you needed to do was to make sure the aircraft was positioned either against the real horizon or the artificial horizon. There was a turn and bank indicator, which indicated the amount of turn, the rate of turn, and the amount of bank. There was an airspeed indicator, which indicated the airspeed, and there was an altimeter, which gave one the height in feet. The engine instruments were on the right-hand side of the panel, and these consisted of a boost gauge, which was the amount of boost on the engine. This was really, if you like, the amount of throttle opening. There was a RPM indicator for each engine, which showed you the RPM of the propeller on the engine. There were extinguisher buttons above these. And there was a feathering button, which in case of need, one could press to feather the aircraft propeller. The propeller on the appropriate engine, if you lost an engine, instead of letting it windmill, you feathered the blades fore and aft so that it reduced the drag. these instruments were in front of the engineer station, the engine. On the right-hand side of the cockpit were gauges for fuel in the tanks, various tanks, and on some aircraft there were flow meters to register the flow to the engine, the amount of gallons per hour to the engines. And there were tank change levers. I should describe the tank system here. On the Lancaster, there were six tanks, three in each wing. The inboard tanks had 580 gallons. The middle tanks between the two engines and the wing carried 364 gallons. And the outboard tanks carried 112, I believe, or 114 gallons. The outboard tanks fed into the middle tanks, but the middle and inboard tanks fed individually to whichever engine they were selected on. Engineer's job was to balance the fuel load, and we normally took off on the inboard tanks, and after an hour we would switch to the middle tank, and this would be emptied sufficient to enable the outboard tank contents to be pumped into the middle tanks to cut down the weight on the wingtips. We seldom flew at maximum tankage. The aircraft's maximum all-up weight at that time was 65 or 66,000 pounds, with a maximum overload up to 68,000 pounds. And what had to be done was balance the bomb load with the flight distance to achieve the optimum amount of fuel to be carried. What this would mean is that you'd have enough fuel to get you there and back, and perhaps 1 hour extra fuel for a diversion. So unless one was flying empty and on very long range, one never flew with full tanks, or hardly ever flew with full tanks. That was the engineer's main job, to balance the fuel load, to watch the temperatures, to watch the RPMs, and he would react to the pilot's commands.
He didn't do it. He stood ready. In your case, he could take over from you if you were.
In my case, if anything had happened to me, he would get me out of my seat and lay me carefully down, and he would take over.
And that was his main role.
Yes, but I think it important to remember that RAF Bomber Command only flew one pilot, and there was only a single control. US heavy aircraft had two pilots, pilot and the co-pilot, and they had dual control, and they had larger crews altogether.
Now, actually, let's look at the other crew as they affect. I mean, it's fairly obvious what the gunners were doing, but what was the role of that? So that's the flight engineer. What was the role of the wireless operator? Or, I mean, because he has a role in a navigator. How did they together feed into you?
Well, I think the navigator obviously was the key member of the crew. He would have given the pilot the first course to fly. On a daylight, it was a matter of formating in the correct position and following the leader. The lead aircraft would be getting the direction, but one's navigator would ensure that this was the sort of course or track which he would have selected had he been leader. He would follow the route and plot it the whole way. The wireless operator's principal duty was to listen out for radio messages, or wireless messages as we called them then, whether there would be a change in wind or predicted wind ahead, whether there was a recall, or whether there was any other news that was important to the operation.
Would he also be monitoring the sort of GH business and things like that?
Not the wireless operator, no. This was purely the navigator's
job. So
he'd job.
Have a set.
The navigator would have the set, and he'd have the small sort of 6-inch dial on which he could see the pulses which indicated where the number zero numbers and so on.
Now, did you some aircraft had a sort of? I mean, you were expected to maintain wireless silence, weren't you?
Oh, at all times, yes.
And what about intercom silence? That was down to you, wasn't it?
Well, intercom silence was down to the individual aircraft, but the advice was to keep all chatter to a minimum, because German radio intercepts could listen to chatter from aircraft when they were taking off. I know, in fact, that when the large US formations were forming up over the UK, they talked incessantly. They took about 2 hours to form up before they set off, and German radio locators had got the sort of flight direction, the heights they were flying, long before they crossed the channel. In our case, we were as quiet as mice. Less said, the better. The only person who really were allowed to speak, but I, the captain, giving the instructions, the navigator passing a new course or new height or any information to the skipper, the wireless operator if he got the occasional message, and the gunners if they saw any untoward activity or opposition.
Now, so you've taken off, you're in formation, loose formation.
Yes.
And you're setting off to, well, I mean, right. One of the places you went to, Hanrichut or Hulls or Ham or, you know, daytime operation. So what happens next?
Well, the GH system provided a beam on which one could fly over the target. It provided two other beams. One was a open bomb doors beam, and the other was release the bombs beam. The intersection of the release the bomb and the course over the target meant that if all things being equal, we were at the right height, the right airspeed, the winds were in the right direction, as predicted, the bombs would fall on target.
Now, as you were flying out, I mean, this is March 1945.
Yes.
Much of what you're flying over is already occupied.
We flew over, say, occupied France or Belgium, and then would turn towards the east to the Ruhr area. Our principal targets were the small synthetic fuel units, which the Germans had set up all through the Ruhr, using basically coal and coke to produce high-octane engine fuel. And our track over these targets was usually on a north-south direction or a south-north direction.
And it was in the Ruhr?
Basically in the Ruhr, in the heavy industrial areas, which were, you know, the most heaviest.
And these are small targets?
Very small. They would be no more than 50 to 100 yards in extent.
So this is not mass carpet bombing. This is, you're meant to hit what you're aiming.
That's right.
Now, as you, anything happening on the route out before you get to, where does the danger area start?
I mean, well, the danger, there could be danger from fighters, but the only fighters that would be, if you like, to the west of the front line would probably be fast jets, which one occasionally saw high up merely by the fact that they had left a condensation trail. In daylight, we had RAF fighter protection. I hardly ever saw them. It wasn't the mass fighter protection that the US provided for their aircraft, for obvious reasons. We had a few squadrons of aircraft which were high up just watching, and I imagine in their case hoping. In our case, we hope they didn't see any opposition.
Now, did you ever come across fighters during your approach runs?
No.
German fighters. No point in getting too tangled up in this.
No.
Because this is very near the end. I mean,
that's right. And the main opposition in the Ruhr was flak or anti-aircraft fire.
Now, when would you start, well, you start getting that over the
well,
Ruhr?
Well, bearing in mind, we would normally approach the Ruhr from the west, i.e. on an easterly direction. And gradually the whole ensemble would turn north or south, depending on the direction of the final target. What happened to our squadron would be that in each VIC there was a GH leader. That aircraft navigator advised his pilot how to fly so that he followed the correct beam.
Now, each aircraft had a GH, but there was a GH leader.
There was a GH leader. And in the case of 115, the lead aircraft would follow the beam with his two appropriate aircraft in the VIC. The next VIC would follow, and so on. But in each VIC, there was an individual navigator who was guiding the aircraft along that approach beam. And in our case, we flew at 16,600 feet at 160 miles per hour without changing course or height. So that in one case we were a sitting duck, if you like, while we maintained that course for 20 minutes to half an hour.
So you had to fly at a specific
time. Yes, you had to get on that beam. Yeah, you had to be on the beam fairly early. You couldn't just sort of approach it just before the target and turn violently, you know, to port or starboard. That would be useless. You had to have a long, steady approach. You had to get the aircraft settled in so that it was flying very accurately the required height and airspeed.
Now, what about German flak? I mean, because that's...
Yes, well, as we approached the bomb line or the front line, we would start throwing out window, or the bomb aimer would disperse window.
So now, many. Can you just explain what that was and how you...
Yeah, window were sort of metallic strips between a foot or 2 feet in length. And they were packed in small bundles. And as they were thrown out of the small chute provided, the thousands of strips would individually each reflect to a German radar system a small dot, and the hope was that amongst the thousands of dots on a radar screen he couldn't detect which was an aircraft and which was window. He got just a blurred screen, in fact, if it worked correctly. Now, in our case, with the prevailing winds usually from the west to southwest, as our group flew, say, north, the window we dropped would drift to our starboard side, i.e. to the east, over the Ruhr, and one could see that flying along with this window drifting away from us, you could see the flak following our progress, but perhaps a mile or half a mile to the east. We tried to operate above cloud because that gave the German flak no opportunity to use their optical sights. If we got a cloud break, the flak immediately came through the hole in the cloud, so that window was ineffective then once they got optical sights on, you know, an aircraft. They were very accurate, but it was very interesting to see the window, how effective window could be.
Now, what about when? What was German? What was it like when it was round you, or did you never actually have it near you?
We didn't get hit, but we got it close to the aircraft and in the group or in the squadron formation, and some aircraft got flak hits, but not one of our aircraft whilst I was flying was actually lost.
What did it look like? Well, I mean, in daylight. I mean, we all got a picture of it.
Puffs of black smoke. Just puffs of black smoke. If it was near, you could sort of get a sound, and that was it. But as a pilot trying to maintain an exact height and exact speed, and in a tight VIC formation, there wasn't really time to start looking, you know, outward to see if there was a bit of flak coming along. The gunners did, of course, and they would sometimes crisis a bit near skip or something like that. But there was no way we could deviate.
So you just had to keep going.
We just had to stay on the same.
Now, what about the bomb aimer's role as you approach a target?
Yes.
Because it almost seems like you don't need a bomb aimer if you've got this SG.
In fact, most of his activity up to that point would have been if he could spot any ground features and feed them to the navigator so that he got an accurate position. But his job coming up to the target would be to arm the bombs. He selected all the bomb switches.
What do you mean by that?
Well, let's explain the bomb bay and the bombing system on a Lancaster. The Lancaster had a very large bomb bay, both in length, in width and depth, and could carry all types of heavy weaponry. It had five rows of three bomb adapters, which meant that you could, if you like, carry 15 1,000-pound bombs, three abreast and five rows fore and aft, or any number of adaptions to that. You could carry a 4,000-pound or 8,000-pound bomb in a centre position and surround that with smaller bombs, 500-pounders or 1,000-pounders. The bombing on a Lancaster, unless you dropped all the bombs at the same time, which one didn't, the bombs were phased so that the aircraft remained in balance. If you had 15 bombs on board and you dropped the front ones first, then the aircraft's center of gravity would change very rapidly. So that what happened was that they were released in a pattern, so that perhaps one at the front fell and one at the rear and so on, so that the aircraft, to the best of the bomb aimer's ability, remained stable. The bomb aimer armed his bombs. He would say bomb doors are opening, Skip, i.e. he'd seen the lead aircraft open its bomb doors, and the pilot would open the bomb bay doors, carrying on. The bomb aimer then would pick up his little bomb switch, a little tit as we called it, and he would watch the aircraft he was formating on very closely. As soon as he saw the first bomb leave the lead aircraft, he would just press his tit and the bombs would fall away, and he would say, "Bombs away, skipper," and then he'd look into the small window which he was provided with, into the bomb bay, to see if the bombs had gone or whether there was a hang-up, and he would say, "Close the bomb doors," and the pilot would close the bomb doors and we would carry on.
Now, what would you do once you'd dropped your bombs? Would you turn sharply away?
No, not you couldn't really with the formations that we had, so that we would just proceed as we were, past the target, and then we would course would be set towards the UK again, still in formation, and we wouldn't break that sort of loose formation until we were approaching our airfield.
Now, one thing. The return flight, just you'd maintain exactly the same
yes,
everything.
Yes, we
so
would.
In a sense, no different.
No different.
The aircraft was a bit
lighter. That's right.